In a world where polemical debate between theists and atheists is reaching a fever pitch, some seek to find common understanding and agreement. This is a place where we begin with differences and end with similarities. This is Apologia.
Hello and welcome to Apologia. My name is Zachary Moore and I'll be moderating and participating in the discussion today. As always, Apologia is a group of theists and atheists who are here for a friendly roundtable discussion about our different perspectives and also where we can find agreement. If you happen to have feedback for the discussion, you can give it at the website for this podcast, which is hosted at drzach.net. Today we have Kevin Harris, who is the Minister of Apologetics at the First Baptist Church of Colleyville, as well as Dan Sawyer, who is the author of Sculpting God, and whose work you can find at jdsawyer.net, and is also the co-host of the Polyschismatic Reprobates Hour. Gentlemen, welcome to the discussion.
Thank you.
Howdy.
All right, well, today we're going to continue what we began last week with the Jesus myth hypothesis, and this covered the arguments from silence. Just to summarize these briefly, that section of the hypothesis contends that the earliest glimpse of Christian literature, that is, the letters of Paul, do not contain references to the narrative details of a historical Jesus that are written about in the four Gospels, even though one would expect Paul to be aware of the same basic Gospel narratives that we know today. It also points out that other writers and historians from the first century who would be expected to be aware of the kinds of events that are recorded in the Gospels, in fact, know nothing about them, and the writers learn about Christianity exclusively from the claims of Christians and not from any objective historical confirmation. Now we're going to examine the arguments from similarity, which sometimes gets the lion's share of attention directed at the Jesus myth hypothesis, even though they only comprise a section of it. Briefly, this section of the hypothesis addresses the various literary sources which would have been available to the writers of the Gospels, as well as to the early Christian movement, to which it is plausible to argue that their influence can be seen in both the theology and literature of early Christianity. All too often, this part of the hypothesis is paraphrased to mean that, quote, well, Christians just copied from source X or source Y or Z, as if this fact is meant to be a condemnation of Christianity in and of itself. One could certainly argue that most Orthodox Christians operate under the assumption that, as a true account of history, the Gospels represent a unique narrative, but this is not necessarily the case, and even if it were, simply puncturing this lone conceptual bubble is not enough to overturn the claim of historicity. Any work of literature reflects the particular culture and environment of its author. For example, Tolkien studied ancient Germanic and Norse mythology in depth, and he was also a staunch Roman Catholic. It's not surprising, then, that many of his characters leap right out of the pages of the Old Norse poetic sagas of the Elder Edda, nor that the theology of Middle Earth is very similar to Catholicism. But it would be foolish to dismiss, let's say, the character of Gandalf as worthless because his name was taken directly out of another work. Or to condemn Frodo as a cryptic papist because he prays to Varda for supernatural intervention. This kind of reductionist approach not only does a disservice to what the author had intended for his work, and we happen to know quite explicitly that Tolkien did not intend for any kind of allegorical understanding of it, but it also fails to appreciate the importance of these borrowed archetypes and themes as meaningful modes of communication. However, it is also clear that our understanding of Tolkien's influences makes it very, very unlikely that The Lord of the Rings was a divinely inspired work, as much as some people might like to believe it. So what we're going to try to do,
Zach,
today,
you're just puncturing my entire devotional life with that. How dare you?
I know it. So what we're going to try to do today is to provide a relatively well-rounded summary of the various influences that were not only available to the Gospel writers, but were also likely used by them, in that we can find parallels between a specific influence and a specific Gospel passage or foundational concept. These will include the archetypical characteristics of mythical figures, which existed previous to as well as contemporaneously with Christianity, known works of fiction that existed previous to the Gospels, legendary tales of great men that lived prior to when the historical Jesus would have lived, as well as existing literary characters in Jewish history. So to start off with, I want to look at how the character of Jesus shares many archetypical characteristics with previous and contemporary mythical figures, gods, or divine creatures. And unfortunately, the single work that tends to get referenced most often when you start talking about this is Kersey Graves' The World's 16 Crucified Saviors. And Kersey Graves was, I believe he actually started off as a Quaker, and he was a pastor for a while, and eventually became part of the early 19th century free thought movement. But he wrote this book to explain and to argue that the character of Jesus is basically a retelling of the same stories that have been told over and over again about all these different gods throughout human history. And he comes up with a list of 16 of them, which he says are all, in addition to Jesus, of course, are all crucified saviors that have existed. And this list tends to get copied a lot, just sort of taken right out of his work. And you can actually find his work at the secular web, the Internet Infidels. They have the whole thing there, although they have a disclaimer posted above it, because you can tell that they're not too thrilled with the scholarship there. But he has
the reasons that they're not thrilled with the scholarship are because Graves was writing in the time he was writing before the development of the historical critical method, and he wrote a popular book, which means it was not properly sourced, not by even the academic standards of the time. So chasing down his sources is exceedingly difficult. In some cases, he's very easy to verify. In others, any sources that exist are in languages that are frankly unavailable to us. There's also the problem of selection bias. Most of, this is prominent throughout most of 19th century mythicism. The Christ myth hypothesis in the 19th century was spurred on by the rapid missionization of the Eastern world. And if you read the book put out by Wycliffe Bible Translators, which is a missions organization, Eternity in Their Hearts, it's actually very much the same thing as Graves, as far as pointing out the parallels, but they're doing it from a God prepped the land for us type of perspective. The problem with using missionaries as sources when it comes to mythology is they are going to give undue weight to similarities, because that's what they're familiar with and they're looking for a way to communicate.
Right.
And what made it back from these other cultures was tainted by selection bias, and often was held up as being far more significant in the native religious systems than they really were.
Right. And that's not to say that that because he was not very scholarly in his approach, that he's wrong. But it is saying that you can't trust it necessarily.
Right, use it uncritically.
Without actually going through it yourself. And I actually did that. I spent a great deal of time going through every single one of his 16 saviors. And I will say that out of the 16, there are only two that I would consider in any way Christ-like. And those would be Tammuz of Samaria and Prometheus. And both of these were these characters, although Tammuz, in Graves' work, he asserts that Tammuz was the one who was crucified. In actuality, it was his consort, Ishtar, who was crucified when she went into the other. Is that
correct? Well, actually, that's one of two traditions. Tradition that Graves references is one that actually shows up in oblique references in the Bible and comes down to us through some of the surviving Babylonian epics. And it has that Tammuz was a corn king and was crucified to bring fertility to the land. His blood was supposed to fertilize the land and cause the land to be reborn.
Right.
The problem was that his consort, Ishtar, didn't like this arrangement at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she refused to perform her function as the goddess of fertility until the rest of the gods got it in their heads to let him back out of the underworld. Because of this, the land went barren. The cows didn't breed, the corn didn't grow, or the grain didn't grow. And she went down into the underworld, and eventually spent time in the underworld until the gods got so fed up with hearing the people complaining about not being able to eat that they let them go.
Right. Okay. But there is an element of crucifixion. One story it's Tammuz, the other story it's Ishtar. But there's definitely a dying and a resurrection that's going on there.
Yes.
So that's, I would say that's relatively Christ-like. And the other one is the story of Prometheus, who was, you know, was the bringer of light, the, you know, the savior of humanity. And for his troubles, he was chained to, he wasn't crucified on a cross, but he was chained up on the top of a mountain, the Caucasus Mountains, and sort of tortured there. And so that's Christ-like enough for me to say that that's okay. That's a pretty good parallel. The rest of them that he has are much less persuasive. There are a number of them that are associated with a cross or with crucifixion in some sort of abstract way, like several incarnations of Vishnu are sort of astrally crucified or crucified in space, and it's unclear exactly what that means. And there's also a couple of guys, Indra and Mithra, who use cross-shaped weapons. You've got Quetzalcoatl, who wore a cross as a, you know, as a figure on his back. But it's not quite clear if he was actually crucified. Of course, the Mormons love that because they say that Quetzalcoatl was actually Jesus who had come to the New World. And there's also this guy, Isis of the Gauls, who I think is identified as Cuchulainn of the Irish, who, when he was fighting to the death, he tied himself up to a tree so he would be able to stay upright to face his enemies. But that's hardly a crucifixion in my estimation.
Yeah, a closer parallel that Graves didn't know about that comes out of the ancient Gallic civilization is the crucifixion of Baldur, who was hung on a tree by his father. Yeah, I can't remember what for, but there's a lot of debate as to whether that myth arose pre or post Christianization in the Gallic world, because there aren't written records going back that far.
Yeah. And then the rest of them, I cannot find anything that implies a cross or a crucifixion, or I can't even identify that these things actually exist, and these would include Attis, who we do know a bit about, but he actually died because he castrated himself. There's Quirinius of Rome, an early state god who is sort of identified with Romulus, but there's definitely nothing about crucifixion there. Thulis of Egypt, Alcestos of Euripides is a character in the play. He's not even crucified. The Buddha, I really can't. I mean, there are some other parallels, but definitely not crucifixion. And then there's a few others that I can't even find any references to outside of Graves, like Yao of Nepal, Crite of Chaldea, and Bali of Orissa. So it's really not a very good list at all. There's a couple on them that are kind of good, but he really sort of misses the boat with a lot of these, I think.
No arguments here.
Yeah. But there are some other mythical traditions, mythical characters that existed prior to Jesus that we can look to now, and it's kind of surprising that Graves didn't actually pay attention to them. But Osiris and Dionysus, who actually sort of were sort of combined into one mythical concept later in the ancient world. But Osiris, of course, was an Egyptian god. He was the brother and husband of Isis. That was not such a big deal back in Egyptian times. And he was murdered by his brother. He was actually shut up in a coffin. And his sister and wife, Isis, and his other sister, Nephthys, actually went to find. So they went searching for Osiris's body, which calls to mind the women searching or going to the tomb of Jesus after he was killed. And Isis reassembled his body. She was able to put together all the pieces of his body except for his penis, which she actually
swallowed. Right.
I think she made a new one.
Different. Okay, different versions of the story.
A couple different.
In some of them, she swallows the penis to conceive Osiris or to conceive Horus.
Another one, I think she makes a new one out of gold.
Yes.
But at any rate, so she revives him temporarily and copulates with him, and that allows for the conception of Horus, who is their son. And then after this, Osiris goes to the underworld to be Lord of the Dead. So there's some obvious, you know, thematic parallels. So, and the other one, Dionysus, is also the son of a god and a mortal woman. His mother was Semele, I believe that's... Mm-hmm. Right. And his father was Zeus, of course. He fathered just about everybody back then, except for Theseus. That was Poseidon. But Dionysus was known as the god of wine, the liberator. He was actually born twice. He was born once from his mother. And then in one tradition, Zeus actually takes him. He's not fully developed. And Zeus takes the fetus and sews him up in his scrotum and gestates him there. So he's born twice. He's hidden in his infancy to escape the wrath of Hera, which calls to mind Jesus being hidden in Egypt to escape the wrath of Herod. And there's quite a bit of this. You're more familiar with this than I am. The Bacchae, which is a play written by Euripides.
Yeah, I've got it right here.
Yeah. What can you tell us about this?
Well, the Bacchae is a 250 BC roundabout, or 290 BC. And it was the liturgical play of the rites of the Bacchanalia, which was the annual Christmas celebration to the god of wine, centered around the solstice, you know, celebrate so that you encourage the sun to come back. The first monologue of the Bacchae is Dionysus describing who he is and particularly defending his mother's virginity, his own divine birth, and his claim to be a god and a deliverer. Because in very explicit terms.
Because that has been called into question, actually. Some people are saying that his mother conceived him illegitimately or something like that, if I remember.
Right. Well, he's actually defending her against that charge. Let me see if I can find the exact passage here. I don't want to read the whole thing. Let's see. Okay, here we go. The city first in Hellas now, this is line 20, by the way. The city first in Hellas now shrills and echoes to my women's cries, their ecstasy of joy. Here in Thebes, I bound the fawnskin to the women's flesh and armed their hands with shafts of ivy. For I have come to refute the slander spoken by my mother's sisters, those who least had the right to slander her. They said that Dionysus was no son of Zeus, but Semele had slept beside a man in love and fathered her fathered off her shame on Zeus. A fraud, they sneered, contrived by Cadmus to protect his daughter's name. They said she lied, and Zeus, in anger at that lie, blasted her with lightning. And then he goes on to explain that it was actually the blasting her with lightning that conceived him in the first place.
Right, exactly. And so that recalls the Jewish rebuttal to the claims of Jesus's virgin birth. You know, the claim that he was the son of Ben Panthera, this Roman soldier. Which is kind of interesting. But these two characters, Osiris and Dionysus together, were sort of identified as sort of the same person. And they formed the basis for a dying and rising god motif that became popular as the basis of various mystery religions. And these mystery religions were
ubiquitous
all over the ancient world. And they were actually they sort of supplanted the old state religion, which you kind of did just because you had to. You know, it wasn't something that we consider a religion today. I mean, maybe some people who practice as Catholics, you might think, well, this is just something you do and you don't really think about it. But the mystery religions offered something different because this is something you did because you wanted to do it. And they offered, you know, secret rites and secret doctrines, and you would be initiated into these things. And so there would be something about being a member of this that made you distinct from everybody else. And there are several of these. I think the earliest one were the Eleusinian Mysteries, which were focused around Demeter and Persephone, which is really similar to the Tammuz and Ishtar story from before, where they cycle between the underworld and the overworld, just explaining this, you know, this fertility paradigm, this fertility archetype. And then later we have the Orphic Mysteries, in which you have this Osiris Dionysus is a big part of that. And it's also tied in, it gets the name from Orpheus, who was another guy who descended and returned from the underworld. And at the same time, or roughly the same time, you have the Mithraic Mysteries, which came from Persia out of Zoroastrianism. In which you had this character of Mithra, who was later became really, really popular as sort of he was recast as Mithras, and became really popular with the Romans, especially the Roman army. And you've got a lot of astrological symbolism, and most of it centers around the slaughtering of a bull and But anyway, aside from that, there's many apparent similarities between Mithraism and Christianity, although at this
point it's worth pointing out that the earliest doctrinal records we have of the Mithraic mysteries come from the late first century and are contemporaneous with Christianity.
So it's difficult to know. Yeah.
Right. It's difficult to know whether Christianity is dependent on Mithraism or whether Mithraism is dependent on Christianity or if they are both arising from the same cultural background contemporaneously.
Right. So aside from this Osiris-Dionysus mystery cult system, there are a couple other things I did want to point out as regards to various mythical figures. The idea of the apotheosis death, that is that you have a death occurring for somebody that divinizes them. And what happens is that the body actually disappears and it's no longer able to be found. Which implies then in the story, in the narrative, that character has actually been called up to heaven, has actually been divinized. And there are several characters. Hercules is a really obvious one. Aeneas is another really obvious one where something happens and either they die and their body disappears or they just disappear completely. And it is assumed that because of this sudden disappearance or the disappearance of their body, that they have now become a divine entity and then they have gone up to heaven. And this, of course, recalls the original ending of Mark, because we know that the original ending of Mark does not have any resurrection appearances and all it has is an empty tomb. And so this could be interpreted to be a similar situation to these other mythical characters who were known to have a death occur or some event occur where their body would disappear and would leave only, it would make sense for them to leave an empty tomb, and because the conclusion then would be that this person has become divinized, and so there'd be no reason for, or it'd be unnecessary to have a resurrection account.
Mm-hmm. This would be a good time to bring up a couple of things. One of them is the words of Justin Martyr.
Right.
In his second apology, he is writing to pagans wondering why they find the Christian story so incredible. He says, quote, "And when we say also that the Word, who is first begotten of God, was born for us without sexual union, Jesus Christ our teacher, and that he was crucified and died and rose again and ascended into heaven, we propound nothing new beyond what you believe concerning those whom you call the sons of Zeus. For you know how many sons of Zeus your esteemed writers speak. Hermes, the interpreting word and teacher of all." The Hermetic religious system, by the way, underlay the cult and philosophy underlay the cults of Osiris, Isis, and Dionysus. And they are expounded, their rituals and history are expounded quite a bit in Apuleius's book, The Golden Ass. He was actually an initiate and broke his vows of silence. Asclepius, who thought he was a great healer after being struck by a thunderbolt, ascended to heaven. And Dionysus, too, was torn into pieces. And Hercules, when he had committed himself to the flames to escape his pains, and the Dioscuri, the sons of Leda, and Perseus, son of Danae, and Bellerophon, who, though of mortal origin, rose to heaven on the horse Pegasus. For what shall I say of Adrian, who, and those like her, who have been said to have been placed among the stars? And what of your deceased emperors, whom you think it right to deify, and on whose behalf you produce someone who swears that he has seen the burning Caesar ascend to heaven from the funeral pyre? End quote.
Yeah. So this is coming from, one of the first Christian apologists, very aware of these parallels and basically making the case that Jesus is, or that the story of Jesus falls under the same category as these things that have already been known to exist. So Kevin, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about, how these parallels and these mythical archetypes, how these are received in among apologetics today, and what your take on it is, whether you think that Justin Martyr was on the ball or whether you prefer C.S. Lewis's approach, that myth became reality.
What you guys did, especially what you did, Zach, is very commendable in that you took Percy Graves, and you went through it and kind of checked it out for yourself to see what's going on here with the parallelism and everything. And the people did the same thing when Frazier wrote his Golden Bough everybody at Oxford is checking that out.
Because right.
I think he was probably one of the first who is in semi-modern times, anyway, that in modern times that really tried to make a case there, and that was kind of the going thing for a while, the parallelisms and everything. And C.S. Lewis tells a story of he was sitting in front of the fire with the most hard-boiled atheist at Oxford at the time, just hardcore skeptic of skeptics. And the guy lit his pipe up, and he said, rum thing, all that dying and rising God from Frasier. They were talking about Jesus, and he said, it looks like it might actually have happened once.
Yeah.
And C.S. Lewis nearly fell out of his chair, you know, because he said, are you actually giving any credibility to Christianity whatsoever? Because the guy was a staunch opponent of it, you know, and everything. But so, you know, this has been around, and usually when you go to Chrissy Graves and when you go to some other things, people don't check it out, and it spreads like a virus on the internet. They go to their favorite websites. They go to Acharya S. I think that's how you pronounce her name. And these exaggerated claims and these unverified claims and even downright false claims are often put into the lexicon. And suddenly you go, you know, you got everybody quoting them, and nobody doing any work, you know, to check it out or anything like that. So I'm glad to see some due diligence there, you know, on seeing it. And parallels are interesting, you know, they're very interesting to look at in all aspects of history and looking for patterns and things like that. One of the things that my own reading of it has shown is that scholars really don't hold a lot of credibility to the parallels, and they're just seen as interesting. The layman, we're the ones who tend to get excited about some things like this, and so you know, the parallels are interesting. One thing about Justin Martyr is that he was arguing for Christians to not be persecuted, because he's saying, mm-hmm. "Look, Christian teachings and claims are not all that different from the beliefs,
yes.
you know, and of other philosophies and religions that enjoyed Rome's favor." So he wrote to the emperor and said, "Look, why are you persecuting Christians when the guys that you guys have all the, you know, the guys that have your favor, they believe in
same kind of stuff,
Perseus and Pegasus and you know, Hercules and you know, the sons of Jupiter, you know, the whole bit." So he did make a case there. I think he also thought, even from his own investigations and his preparation for writing the emperor, that he thought, you know, I wonder if the devil had something to do with this.
Yeah, he states, you know, in the first apology, he says that the demons read the prophecies and enacted them before Christ came in order to discredit him.
Yeah, you know, so he was apparently theorizing and trying to, you know, think it through. I do like C.S. Lewis's approach, since C.S. Lewis is such a literary expert, and that is, and so familiar with mythology and literature, you know, past and present. And he says it seems that there is a hero motif that emerges, and you see it, almost like an anticipation, and maybe it's just people's intuition of, the way things are in the universe and the way things ought to be and what the needs and the cries of man's heart is. And so that these hero motifs tend to emerge. And of course, at that point, that's why he says that Christ is myth come reality, and that Christ literally fulfilled what the myths anticipated, and so on. Both of those are, you know, both of those are interesting. But, you know, the main point is investigating these on a case by case and seeing what's going on. The third thing that I'll say quickly is that, as you guys did point out, while most of these dying and rising gods predated Christianity, what we know about them tends to post-date Christianity. Adonis is, as I recall, about 150 A.D. So when we started getting versions of the death and resurrection of Adonis, that was after A.D. 150. There could have been borrowing the other way. It's a good point about Mithra. You know, who came first? Who influenced who? And so on. Was there a conscience or even an unconscious nod to Christianity? Was it the other way around? And so I think that's the only thing that's gotten scholars' attention is when these accounts started emerging and started circulating and, you know, the timing and the whole bit.
It's someone I need to recommend for who lays out a good mythology for or good methodology for analyzing parallels and adjudicating whether you have direct borrowing or whether you have a common cultural tradition that's being inflected is Jonathan Z. Smith. He's done quite a lot of work on Judaism and the contemporaneous religions in the Middle East. And he does quite good work. I believe he's actually a believer. He was at the time he started writing. He's up in at the University of Chicago, I think. Anyway, he does. He's a mythologist and a biblical historian, and he lays out. See if I can remember it off the top of my head. When you have elements that are direct quotes, or significant non-common elements, or direct references from one to the other, you can be certain that there was a deliberate copying going on. When you have common mythemes that line up all the way, you can be certain only that there is a common tradition from which they are both drawing.
Right. And I think that's an important point to make. Just by pointing out these parallels, you don't necessarily have to conclude that there was borrowing or copying. You know, the common conception of this is that Jesus is a Xerox of, you know, Attis or Adonis or whatever. That's not, and you see a lot of these lists. Oh, all these guys were born on December 25th. All these guys had 12 disciples. All these guys had a virgin mother. And it makes it look like they're carbon copies of each other, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. And those I'm skeptical of anyway, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the case that Adonis is a copy of Jesus or Jesus is a copy of Adonis, because they both could independently draw their mythical tradition from something that existed prior to them. So you could have a contemporary similarity there, which just speaks to a shared history, a shared mythical tradition, and not necessarily copying. I mean, that's the thing I think that really it's an emotionally charged concept, because it makes it seem like the concept of Jesus was stolen from somebody else, you know, and that's the implication there. And I think that's what really gets Christians on the defensive, is that, you know, we didn't steal our concept of Jesus. I mean, that I think that really, you know, turns them more than anything else is that sort of implied accusation. And it doesn't necessarily mean that. I mean, all the evidence that we've laid out just now does not mean that Christians stole. And even if there was borrowing, there is not that implication of stealing that we would give today, because we have a totally different concept of, you know, what it means to derive your content from somebody else today in the age of patents and copyright. They didn't have that back then. So there was not that ethical context to it.
That's a very good point.
Yes, it's very important.
You know, 2 points there. One, similarities don't necessarily prove same source. Similarities don't prove legend. Similarities are, again, just could be similarities, just like the Lincoln and Kennedy similarities are uncanny. You ever Google those, look at the similarities, it's like, it's uncanny, you know, when you look at that. The second one is that even today, maybe you'll read an author in a literary club, they'll hang around and go, you know, this guy's favorite writer is Stephen King, let's say that. And you can tell from reading his work that he's doing Stephen King. You see the same kind of phraseology. You see the way he present mm-hmm. that. In fact, if you look hard enough, you'll even see a passage that he constructed that just like Stephen King did and things like that. And there's accusations of plagiarism and things like that. And people do that either consciously or unconsciously. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do it consciously as kind of a template. And the Homeric epics and Mark, I don't know if you guys remember that when that book came out.
Dennis McDonald, excellent book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he found some things like that. And I read a few things on the book after looking over the book, but he may have a point there that maybe Mark, the author of the Gospel of Mark, and others would take a passage or take a story or something popular and kind of use the same outline mm-hmm. And tell the truth or form the historical account following a certain template or pattern. And so I suspect that's kind of what was going on, especially since writing was not as, like you guys said, was not as
not common.
Advanced. And so, you know, these guys, you had to have a lot of help, and it took a while. You know, you had your references in front of you. So that could well be the case. I think McDonald pointed out a couple of things similar in Mark and in like Deuteronomy and some things like mm-hmm. that. That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, that's actually a really good segue, because the next set of things
well,
we're
actually
gonna get...
Before we got there, I was going to point out an example of how cultural diffusion does work and how it's known to work.
Yeah, let's hear that.
And it's the sun god mythos underlies a lot, not all, but a lot of the dying and rising gods, and particularly the virgin-born dying and rising gods throughout mythological history. And if you take let's see if I can remember all three of them. Well, let's just take two prominent sun god motifs. You have Hercules, who was by the time that Philo was writing, Hercules was worshipped as a sun god, whether there was originally a guy behind the story or not. And you know, there's the great strength, the heroic death, the bringer of vitality to the peoples he went to, the 12 labors paralleling the 12 signs of the zodiac. The lion's mane that he wore, which is a classic mythological motif for the rays of the sun. And then you have a very similar thing going on with Samson, not quite enough that you can say Samson was just a sun god who was euhumerized, but enough that you can see the influence of one type on another. But back earlier in the Bible, there is a sun god, Enoch, the second son of Adam, who walked 365 days on the earth, or 365 years on the earth, and was ascended to heaven, who later makes an appearance as the author of the Book of Enoch, performing another one of the functions of the sun god, which is bringing light and enlightenment to the people of the world by telling them the true history of the gods. And that's a book that is quoted verbatim in Jude.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But none of that says that Hercules was copying Enoch, or that Enoch was copying Hercules. We know, even through the testimony in the Old Testament and the struggles that Josiah and others went through to rid the land of other gods, that the worship of the sun god is primordial in most cultures. And you would expect that tradition to survive, either as a god remembered as a man, or as a historical man that has been transmuted into a retrospective god.
Because every culture is affected by the sun. You know, the sun is the center of your world, basically.
Yes, particularly if you're an agricultural culture.
Yeah.
So that's an example of how the same myth will arise independently in parallel cultures because of the common circumstances and the common psychology of humanity.
Cool. All right. Well, we need to move on. What Kevin was bringing up about the Odyssey and the parallels between the Odyssey and Mark. Aside from the Odyssey, there are other mythical and fictional stories that we know of that we can point to certain shared themes, even shared details with aspects of the Gospels. And the as you mentioned, the Dennis MacDonald book, The Homeric Epics and the Gospel of Mark, is really the one to read up if you're interested in the Odyssey. And this has actually persuaded Richard Carrier quite effectively. The reason for this is because anybody, we know that the Gospels were originally written in Greek, or at least the earliest manuscripts we have are in Greek. So whoever wrote them was a literate person. And if you were a literate person at that time, you knew Homer forward and backward. It was basically the textbook for Greek, and students were taught to write as if they were Homer and repeat Homer. And they would even be taught to rewrite passages of Homer as prose, as, you know, like a narrative, using different vocabulary or different structure or things like that. So we know that anybody who had a familiarity with Greek enough to write a gospel would have been familiar with Homer and would have been practiced at doing this very thing, that Dennis MacDonald argues, was the case. And, there are a couple good examples that, of course, MacDonald basically goes through and tries to argue that the entire Gospel of Mark is a rewriting of the Odyssey, recasting Jesus in the Odysseus role, trying to show that his rewriting of the Odyssey was a better attempt at, you know, the values that he reflected from the Christian tradition were better than the values of the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that Mark could have done this even if he believed he was writing about a real person, in the same way that contemporary screenwriters will recast historical figures as a Christ figure,
right,
as a way to lionize them.
Right. So again, this is not to me that Mark was doing anything shady or trying to be false in any way. This is just like with Tolkien and influence of Catholicism, this is just what the influence of people's cultural contexts. But if you go to Mark 5, there are a couple of pretty interesting things in there, where he talks about the Jesus casting the demons out of the Gadarene demoniac, and that the demons are, their name is Legion, and there are several of them, and he casts them into a herd of swine that jump off a cliff and die. And this seems to be, this seems to recall in the Odyssey where Circe, they land on Circe's island, and she turns all of Odysseus's men into pigs, and actually a number of them are killed. And also the Gadarene demoniac appears to be a pretty good parallel to retelling of the Cyclops from the Cyclops island, Polyphenus, who calls after Odysseus as he's sailing away, just like the demoniac calls after Jesus as he's sailing away and wants to come with him.
Wants to know what his name is.
Yeah, wants to know his name is. And that aspect, you know, the fact that Jesus wants to, at least in Mark, this concept of the messianic secret, that Jesus tries to keep his identity from people. He doesn't want it getting out who he is. Well, that's also at the end of the Odyssey when Odysseus returns back to Ithaca, except he's in disguise. He doesn't want people to know who he is because he, you know, kind of wants to take his time and spring a trap on everybody. And so he goes around and people recognize him. In fact, I think it's one of his wife's servants, Euryclea, actually recognizes him and washes his feet and anoints his feet with oil.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we see in Mark 14, the unnamed woman washes Jesus's feet. There are a couple other interesting ones. Jesus is able to calm the storms. He's in control of the winds, and Odysseus is given a bag full of wind that he is able to use to control the storm. Odysseus spends a lot of time hanging around with all these sailors, and Jesus spends a lot of time hanging around with fishermen. And in fact, they spend quite a lot of time on the water, which is kind of odd for Judea being a very dry country, except for just the one lake. And there are some other parallels there, but if you want to read a little bit more of that, check out the Dennis MacDonald book. There are some other interesting stories. These are actually just like popular fiction in the ancient Greek culture that have a lot of weird parallels with stories in the gospel, especially the concept of an empty tomb. One of the big one is Kyrias and Kalirawai, in which you have a guy named Kyrias and his wife Kalirawai, and he thinks that he kills her, and she's not actually dead, but she is entombed. and her tomb is then robbed by pirates who, you know, they're in there basically because they're rich and they want to get all the wealth that's in there. And they find out that she's actually alive still. And so they make off with her. They kidnap her. And so Kyrias goes to mourn at the tomb, just like we see the women doing at the end of Mark. And he's presented with an empty tomb. And so we see this empty tomb thing, and it actually comes up again later in the story when it's Kyrias who's thought to be dead, and there's an empty tomb for him. He's not actually dead. And he also almost gets crucified in the story. There are a lot of weird parallels in there.
Where do those sources come from? By the way, I'd love to check those.
Kyrias and Clearaway, these are all available on the web. You can.
It's an ancient novel, romance novel, actually. Yeah. It's And it's written more or less like romance novels today are written. The quality has not gone up.
It's a lot like Romeo and Juliet in that way. Yeah. There's another one called The Ephesian Tale by Xenophon. I'm not sure who wrote Kyrias and Clearaway, where you basically find the same thing. There's a beautiful girl. She appears to die, but she's not really dead. She's buried. She's kidnapped by pirates again, and her fiance goes in search of her. But of course, again, you have an empty tomb. Her fiance, while he's searching for her, gets condemned to the cross. He's crucified. He prays to the gods to save him, and he doesn't actually get a god in person, but this sort of like divine providence. The winds start blowing, and the cross is not really. It's positioned in some unsteady earth, and it sort of blows down and falls into the water and washes away. But that's the Ephesian tale. We find some other parallels to other aspects. There's a story, the story of Daphnis and Chloe, where shepherds find a royal child on the ground among the animals, which sort of recalls back to Jesus's birth among the animals in the manger, and attended to by shepherds. Another thing that we find is a lot of parallels to
the post-resurrection appearances,
right? The post-resurrection
recognized,
right? And I'll just move right into some of these other stories since we're pressed for time.
Do you know when the Ephesian tale was written?
Yeah, actually, I think they would have been about the same time, first century maybe.
I can look it up real quick.
Well, you know, I'm not much of a Wikipedia guy. I got the Ephesian tale here of Xenophon of Ephesus. It's a novel written in the mid-second century CE, mid-second century Common Era. So it's also, it's very similar. We haven't talked about Apollonius of Tyre yet, but I said it's very similar to that, which was a later story. That was 4th century.
Right. In Apollonius of Tyre, I think there's a medical student that found that that saves a woman from death. And you find that in a lot of these other stories about, like, Apollonius of Tyana and Asclepius. The very common story that gets told about either a medical god, like Asclepius was the god of medicine. He was the holy healer, and Apollonius of Tyana was a healer. And there's a story about Apollonius actually raising a dead woman on her wedding day in Rome. She's collapses or something like that, either as she's married or just after she's married. And she's being born out of the city. Everybody's in tears. She's very famous or wealthy or from a wealthy family. And Apollonius stops by and I think just touches her or whispers something in her ear or something like that. And she basically just sits right up and she's fine again.
Robert Price really goes to Apollonius a lot. It goes to that story in some of his examination of this. His main take, I don't know to what extent Bob is a mythicist, but I do know that he goes to that story a lot.
Oh, very much so.
As a parallel, yeah.
Yeah, he has the common apologetic rebuttal to the notion that Apollonius could have is evidence for a mythic template that Jesus also, or that the gospel writers also drew on, is that he comes later enough that the borrowing must have gone the other way. But and thus is more likely to be mythic. But Price points out at great length, actually, in the Deconstructing Jesus, that let's see how did it go. Apollonius is attested to back as far as the first century, and his scriptures, though not being written until the third century, there are references to some of the deeds in his scriptures back before the time of the writing of the Gospels.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, because, you know, most of the stuff that you often read on it is that, you know, it didn't come about until 200 years afterwards. Remember Colin Hemmer, who wrote the Book of Acts in the setting of Hellenistic history, he thinks that it was a deliberate, a conscious
right.
and deliberate reaction against Christianity. You know, when it came about, but any sources that would put that earlier to the first century would be interesting.
Yeah, check out Deconstructing Jesus. Price goes into that quite extensively.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I think most of these novels are roughly contemporaneous.
Yeah, contemporaneous.
Yeah.
When we get into the concept of mythic migration from Christianity to other religions, there's a basic historical error that apologists often commit. Not always, and in the case of something like Mithraism, for example, I think the case can be made quite strongly without committing this error. But apologists make the mistake of assuming that the Christian gospel was ubiquitous by about the beginning of the second century. And it simply wasn't the case. Christianity followed the same kind of expansion curve as did Islam and Mormonism. as far as the addition of followers and the geographical dispersion. And only in certain population centers would their stories have been known before about the mid-third century. After that point, they had presence, you know, most throughout the Mediterranean basin, and were enough of a segment of the population, kind of analogous to how Scientologists are now. You know, anyone who's had any interest or run into Scientologists knows, you know, some of their mythic secrets and has had a good laugh at them.
Or if you've watched South Park.
Right. But if you go back, say, 30 years, yeah, well, there were Scientologists in every city, but, you know, you couldn't even get someone to recognize the name to save your life.
Right.
And when attempting to adjudicate on mythic borrowing, whether it went one direction or the other, or whether there was no borrowing between them, you have to account for the presence of X school of thought in Y location at Z time, which is something that's very easy to forget in our modern world where we have instantaneous communication, overnight travel around the world, and things like that.
That's a good point.
That's true. Yeah, so there's some other legendary great men that I should probably mention. Of course, Romulus, who was probably just a deified, he was the god of Rome. He had a couple of, you mentioned before, Dan, post-mortem appearances. Mm-hmm. He appeared to, of course, he had an apotheosis death of his own where he was, I think it was just fighting in a battle, and then the sky darkened and then he disappeared, and everyone assumed that he had been
taken up
to heaven. But after that, he actually comes back and he appears to some, or at least they claim that he appeared to them, some fairly prominent Roman officials, where he gives something like a great commission to them. He basically comes out and says, look, you know, tell everybody to stop mourning my loss. I've gone on better things, but this is what I want you to do. I want Rome to be the grandest city on the earth. Train up the military because you're going to have to, you know, you're getting the conquest. And I've got this grand vision for Rome. So go out and do this, which sounds a lot like a great commission, actually. There are actually some similar stories about Alexander the Great. He was, of course, also supposed to have been the son of a god, although this was he may have come up with this after he got really famous.
There are a number of historical figures, the two chief among them being Augustus and Alexander the Great, who had all of these mythic elements tacked onto them by the time they died. And we have in both cases very clear parallel historical traditions handed down to us by people who said, well, don't believe this shit. This is state religion. You know, ignore this. But the significant part of that equation for a mythicist is that these things were believed of them in their own lifetime, and very shortly thereafter.
Right. And in fact, it's interesting you mentioned that about Augustus, because J.D. Crossan has written a book called In Search of Paul, where he tries to get at he tries to do for the historical Paul what he did for the historical Jesus, like it or not. And he argues that Paul was basically taking this deification cult of Augustus and turning it on his head and recasting that, basically taking all the language and the metaphor that was used for Augustus and sort of reclaiming it for Jesus. And he basically makes the argument that that's what Pauline theology is all about. For what it's worth. There's another guy that is really interesting, mostly because of one particular aspect in the Gospels, in John 21, this is Pythagoras. Pythagoras was also believed to be the son of a god, Apollo. And he's mostly famous, of course, for geometry class, you know, the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, is how to tell the hypotenuse of a right triangle.
He's also the oldest vegan that we know of.
Yeah, very strict vegetarian. I wouldn't eat anything. He wouldn't even eat fish, and that's where we get into this story, because in John 21, of course, Jesus, this is a post-resurrection appearance, basically the last one in John, and Jesus comes out, and the disciples have all gone back to fishing. I guess they've been dissuaded from being disciples, and they see Jesus. They don't recognize him. And they're not catching anything, and he tells them to try it on the other side of the boat, and they pull all these fish, you know, basically a boat full of fish, and it actually gives a number for it, tells you how many fish there are, 153. Which is kind of an odd, you know. I mean, usually in the Bible when they give numbers for things, so you know, it's 5,000 Israelites and you know, whatever. It's always these nice round numbers.
And it doesn't seem to fit in with the story either, because you know, you've got a bunch of guys, their teacher, their leader, their God has just reappeared from the dead. And who stops to count the fish?
Right. Yeah. Who's going to count 153 when the Son of God's right there in front of you? But what's interesting is that there's a similar story about Pythagoras, in which he comes across, he meets a bunch of fishermen that they've already caught their fish. But of course, he's a vegetarian and he doesn't want to see these fish getting eaten. So he says, well, look, if I predict the correct number of fish that you got in your nets, you let them go, I'll pay you for them. And so he does it. He predicts a number because he's, you know, the son of Apollo. He's got these divine powers, whatever. And so they throw the fish back.
And the number of 153 is one of the sacred Pythagorean numbers.
Right. It's actually
great significance to the cult.
Of course, they were all about these sacred. I mean, he was a mathematician. So imagine a cult started by a mathematician. That's what you get. 153 is a really interesting number. It's the sum of the cubes of its own digits. 1 cubed plus 5 cubed plus 3 cubed. It's the sum of the integer numbers from 1 to 17. And it's also, if you draw two circles such that the circumference of one touches the center of the other, you get this sort of overlapped oval sort of shape, which basically looks like the Christian fish, the ichthus.
Mm-hmm.
And the ratio of the height to the width of this fish shape is 153 to 265. And supposedly this was known as the measure of the fish back then. Because this is how you would draw that fish shape. So this has a lot of really interesting parallels, just because you've got this weird Pythagorean number stuck right in the end of John there. And
this is one of the very, very few instances in the Gospels where, according to say Jonathan Smith's criteria, you can confidently say that this was a direct borrowing. You know, not the story arose out of the common background. The presence of that number, which is nonsensical in the Christian story, but makes all the sense in the world in the Pythagorean story, shows you both that direct borrowing occurred and which direction it occurred in.
Yeah, this does seem to be a little bit more than just, you know, sharing common themes or having a common mythical background.
So the 153 Pythagoras predates the 153 in the...
Yeah, Pythagoras was, yes, quite a ways. Okay. Let's see, when was Pythagoras?
Wow.
He was between 600 and 550
BC.
BC, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very old guy. So this is, I mean, this is a weird little, it is definitely a weird one to grapple with.
Yeah, it is weird because I seem to recall that the Greeks had identified, they thought that there were exactly 153 species of fish in the sea.
Yeah, I've heard that one too. I think it was actually, was it Eusebius that postulated that?
I'm not familiar with that one.
So that 153 was, you know, it was quite a number, especially when it came to fish.
Yeah.
It might have been, you know, I think, let me see here if I can find this. It was known as the measure of the fish.
Measure of the fish.
Because of the ratio,
Yeah, so, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that is kind of weird. But anyway, so those are some legendary characters that lived sort of previously to the gospel accounts and somewhat contemporaneously with the gospel accounts. But of course, you know, we're forgetting some of the obvious borrowings, thematically anyway. And a lot of these are interesting in that Christians really don't have a problem with them. In fact, they go right along with the gospel writers who do play up these parallels. And I'm speaking primarily of Moses, Elijah, or Moses and Elijah, especially, and also Joshua. To a certain extent, Matthew, of course, seems to be writing to a Jewish audience or a Jewish influenced audience, and he, whenever he differs from Mark, the account of Mark, he tends to want to play up the similarities between Jesus and Moses. So you've got this. The situation where Jesus has to hide from a murderous tyrant in Egypt, just like Moses did. You have situations where, you know, Moses is given the law on the mountain. He comes down with the Ten Commandments, and Jesus gives his sermon on the mount, you know, where he's basically giving his interpretation of the law. And there's also several explicit mentions in the text itself suggesting that, you know, Jesus is parallel to Moses, or that people think Jesus is the new Moses. So this is a, you know, a pretty obvious one. Any, you know, from the mythicist position, the argument would follow that, well, anybody who was writing for Christians would obviously have these Jewish literary characters as, you know, right there in front of them, because we know that they would spend a lot of time going through the scriptures and searching through the scriptures. So these characters are literally right in front of their faces. And if they wanted to influence the way that Jesus was portrayed, these are some very obvious, some obvious examples to go to. Elijah, of course, a lot of the miracles that Elijah performs in the Old Testament, Jesus performs later. He also raises people from the dead, you know, just like Asclepius, mm-hmm. and just like Apollonius of Tyana. And
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say there's also the matter of the Gospel of John being a mimesis of the story of Joshua, which John Knox University, hardly a secular institute of skepticism, has its courses on the Gospel of John available online. And they argue that the Gospel of John and Revelation have their unique structure because the author of John was attempting to cast Jesus as a latter-day Joshua, who was an early military savior of the Jewish people.
Right, and of course Joshua and Jesus is the same name. You know, yeah. we use Jesus, which is a Latinized version of a Greek Yeshua. Version of the Yeshua. Yeah, but it's originally Yeshua, which is the same, basically the same name as Yahashua. which is Joshua. They both mean savior, the Yahweh saves. And interestingly enough, Joshua seems to be, I've seen this argument that Joshua, his paternity is given as Joshua, the son of Nun.
Nun.
And Nun is, basically means fish. And so there's some question as to whether this actually implied that he was the son of a fish god of some sort. If so, the obvious example would be Dagon, which was a, contemporary deity at that time, for the ancient Hebrews.
Right. And who, and whose altars Josiah eventually destroyed.
Right. Right. Cause again, we know that there was a lot of other gods that were influenced by that influenced the ancient Hebrews. And so this does not seem to be that big of a stretch, especially, you know, there is somewhat of a tradition. Gideon is another good one of somebody with a questionable name being sort of reborn as a Hebrew hero. And of course, Joshua accomplished many miraculous deeds. He, you know, destroyed the city of Jericho. He was able to stop the sun. He crossed the Jordan. All these things, these miraculous things. And, you know, the Jordan is very closely identified with Jesus also. So we've got three, and there may be more. Are there any other early Jewish characters that might be archetypes that Jesus...
Those are the big ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know Moses and Elijah were obvious enough for the gospel writers themselves
to point them out.
You know, oh, who do they say I am? Oh, they say you're Elijah reborn. Oh, well, why would they say that?
And then every book, every gospel in which that exchange shows up, Moses and Elijah also show up at the Transfiguration as a way of passing the baton to indicate Christ's anointing by God.
Right. Right.
So, you know, King David didn't really parallel. The comparisons are more theological than local, as far as, you know, David and Jesus. But Christian theology seems to put a lot of emphasis on the archetypal king. As much as David is revered, he was still imperfect, and so on. But very much loved. But other than that, you really don't see any parallels between David and Jesus.
No, not really.
David was very military, you know, slew Goliath, he slew 10,000, snuck up on Saul when Saul was, you know, taking a dump and, you know, in the cave.
Right. And Jesus' only military excursion that was recorded is the temple incident.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And so we've got we don't really have parallels there, but we have that seems to be more the go-to archetype.
Right. Yeah. The notion that that Jesus is going to perfect the throne of David is ubiquitous, particularly in Matthew.
And in fact, there's even a question of whether the Messiah had to be Davidic, because there's at one point Jesus appears to play down the notion that he is the heir of David. He says, he refers back to one of the Psalms. He says, well, David says to my Lord. And how could he say to my Lord if it was one of his descendants? You couldn't say that. There seems to be even an argument that there was that you wouldn't even have a direct linear relationship to Jesus from David.
Yeah, but we get into biblical ahistoricity, which is
that's true. That's next week. So I think for this week we've pretty well covered the arguments from similarity, and so we'll pick up next time with the arguments from ahistoricity. But thank you both, gentlemen, for your contributions today, and we'll see you again on Apologia.
Let me just pop in this.